Recording. Hello, we are the Brothers Geek, and this is our podcast. My name is Patrick Schmaltz, with my two brothers, Christopher Schmaltz. Hello, Christopher.
Good morning. Good morning. I'm Chris.
And then, good morning, Andrew Schmaltz.
And I'm Andrew. Good morning, everybody. It's Sunday, April 19th.
April 15th. Wait, what
19th?
Is it? 19th. Whoa.
Yeah, April 15th.
Patrick has no idea what day it is.
Quarantine time. Isolation time. Yep. I had that same. I was like, what day is this? I have no idea what day.
No idea.
God, this month is going by quick. Weird.
It's all blending.
It's going
weird.
We also have a special guest, legendary listener Sean. In the house.
Hey.
Oh, Sean.
Sean in the
Good
house.
Morning.
Legendary
listener from
Welcome.
The beginning. He's put up
to
with
be
us
here.
For 135 episodes.
Yeah, what episode is this?
It feels like episode 250.
Wow. Well,
Sean's connected to the family for years and years and years, so he's put up with us for a lot longer than just 100 and some odd episodes of a podcast.
Pre-recording. Yeah, that's a positive way to spin it. Otherwise, he was bitching about our Picard episode.
I would like to know. Were you complaining about the Picard episodes or complaining about our commentary on the Picard episode?
No, the episodes.
Those were
maybe my least favorite episodes
of the podcast.
All Brothers Geek.
Wow. Did you watch along with Picard with us? Were you interested in the show?
You know, it's funny because I was like, why don't I like these? Because I love the show.
Really? Yeah. Okay.
And here's what I arrived at. Different than Game of Thrones, where there was so much in an episode to talk about.
Right.
The Picard episodes were the same length, right? You guys recorded usually about an hour or 50 minutes. But
yeah, generally.
But not as much happened. And so it was a lot like listening to someone's book club.
It was syndroming.
That's excellent feedback. I love hearing that kind of stuff.
It's good feedback, but he's wrong. I mean,
thanks for coming, Sean. It was
nice.
You guys clearly do not make this podcast for your audience.
That is the truest statement ever.
What does that mean?
My significant other, Ashton, loves the podcast. She loved it even before we started dating, but she did not listen to one single episode of Picard because she just wasn't watching the show. So she has like a 2-month gap. So she would have found those episodes so hard to get through because she's disinterested in the subject matter. Listening to us kind of argue is part of the fun for her. But I love that commentary. That's so funny. I think we did end up syndroming a lot in those episodes. Yeah.
Well, we always would like meander into other Star Trek territory. I feel like I always wanted to change the subject to some other Next Generation episode or Voyager or Space Nine. Something
we demonstrated the breadth of some of our knowledge and viewpoints on the Star Trek universe.
True statement. It's very deep. It's
so
deep and wide.
So screw Legendary Lister Show.
Whatever you got to tell yourself.
Sean, you were on an episode like years ago. Do you remember what episode number you were on? Do you have a recollection of that?
I don't. I remember being on it. I don't remember what number, but it had to be.
It's got to be at least a couple years ago now.
Oh, in the you know, double digit episodes.
Yeah, it must be.
Sure.
All right. Well, welcome back.
Welcome back.
How are you handling the quarantine? Have you been watching anything geeky fun in your downtime? If you have downtime, I don't know.
No, I'm still working, but I am doing a complete rewatch of the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Nice.
What movie are you on right now?
And I'm on Endgame. We watched.
Oh, wow.
We watched Infinity War and Ant-Man and Wasp.
That's awesome.
Oh, wow.
Well, so you did the release order. You started with Iron Man and you went through all 22 or whatever?
I did a, I can't remember where I pulled it down, but an order to watch them in. So in the timeline order. So Captain America first.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Okay. I've never
Captain
done that
Marvel.
Watch.
Yeah,
that is
Captain
the perfect
Marvel
way
is
to
second.
Do it.
That's weird.
Okay. I've never undertaken that rewatch.
That's good.
So, okay, that's interesting.
And then because you guys talked about it, we started watching Veronica Mars. So thanks for that.
That's good. That's good.
Yeah, really good stuff.
Has everybody in your household seen the Marvel movies? Is this a new watching for any of them?
It is. No, they've all seen them, and you often I am by myself.
Okay. It's all good. Yeah. How do you feel about the rewatch and watching them in a timeline order like this? Do they hold up? Or are they interesting?
There is not a bad movie in the whole 22 right. of them. There, mm-hmm. I mean, and the ones that I watch less frequently, I almost appreciate it more because, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy 2, even Iron Man 3.
Mm-hmm. Which Chris deplores. Chris deplores.
They all have something to offer. And then as you watch the, you know, the Infinity Stones are in probably 10 different movies, easy.
Yeah.
And so picking all that up on the rewatch is really good. The connective tissue comes out a little bit more.
Well, yeah, that's cool.
It's funny that you said that they're all like different levels of good because, like, I mean, we talk about like not liking a few of them, but I feel like I think I would agree with you that they're all like some of them are like way better than others, and I don't hate any of them really, like, but there are ones that I prefer to watch over.
I think the only one that I'm genuinely unhappy about is Iron Man 3. The rest of them are varying levels of quality, even Thor Dark World.
Thor Dark World, the best part about Thor Dark World for me is you really get a lot of interplay between Thor and Loki in the second half of the film. Yeah. And that just makes Tom Hiddleston and Chris Hemsworth have such fun brotherly, you know, kind of shitty shit talking chemistry with each other that it just becomes fun to watch those two be on screen together. Really?
Yep.
Yeah. So,
and they even explore more of that in Ragnarok.
They figure out that that's kind of like Chris Hemsworth is really fucking funny. Let him be fucking funny.
The Thor and Loki dynamic is much more like prevalent in that movie. It's like, okay, this is a ridiculous universe. Let's dial it up to be ridiculous, and let's let Hemsworth be like the Thor guy in this ridiculous world. And it's really funny. It's great.
Yeah.
So good.
What's your favorite, Sean?
What's your top?
Oh wow, you know, I think Infinity War and Endgame together are you know, the climax of the whole thing. I really like Black Panther though, and watching that again, that's good. It's just a great movie.
Mm-hmm. We watched that last night. The whole thing, but I watched a significant portion of that last night. That's such a great movie. Everything about it is great. The music is awesome. Mm-hmm. I just love the characters. It's such a good movie. Man,
Christopher, right? you read it much more than I did. I started the arc, but the Black Panther that we see on screen really pulls a lot from that comic book art arc where Coates, I can't pronounce his first name. I'll admit it right now. It's too many vowels for me to kind of understand. That Pulitzer Prize winning writer.
Yes.
Ta-Nehisi Coates, maybe? I'm sorry, I'm butchering the first name. That arc of comics really gets reflected a lot in the movie. You read that arc much more than I did. Is that a correct kind of way to talk about that?
It really is. It's really challenging the assumptions and examining sort of the governance structure and culture and angst of leadership. All of that is woven into the movie itself. It's really, really good.
Works on a lot of levels, man.
Yep.
It's great.
Yep.
Anybody?
The great thing about it is that everything that Killmonger is talking about, you can agree with.
Yeah.
I mean, there is an element to that that is like, you know what? He's making a lot of sense. And
the best villains usually do.
Right. And so it's really strong from that perspective. You know, obviously he's motivated by negativity and a lot of other stuff. But
his motivation comes from a place of hatred and rage.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very much he hates the people that have perpetrated, and he
and his viewpoint spun into a positive sort of perspective is really the winning perspective at the end of the movie. So it's a complex and interesting.
Yeah, it's the villain changes the hero's outlook on things by what he by his viewpoint.
Yep.
He really does bring change to the hero by his villainy, which is works. And Michael B. Jordan is just incredibly fun to watch. He's awesome. So good.
Yep. He is everything. Really good. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Killmonger is like the director even came forward and said he wished he hadn't killed him.
Yeah,
it would have been fun to see Killmonger. And I mean, think about a Killmonger.
Michael B. Jordan is just so good, though.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah,
he's
Killmonger and Doctor Doom. Is that what you were just going to
say? We've said for our kind of like hope for whatever phase we're in, phase four, phase five for the Marvel Cinematic User, they bring Doctor Doom into it somehow because he would be such a fun villain to watch.
He's got to be the prime.
I want an Earth villain. Yeah, I want an Earth.
He's got to be the prime villain for the next 10 movies.
Yeah,
I think that character is so complex and interesting and unbelievable arcs and just a badass in every way.
Well, and he has a really strong perspective on what he's genius level, but he has a really strong perspective on what he feels like the world should be.
Magic. Yeah, brings magic and science. It's just a kick-ass villain.
Sean just did all the rewatch of all of that. Do you have something that you kind of hope and pray for in season or in phase four of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, just as you recently kind of finished the Infinity Saga?
I'm really interested to see how they play out Captain Marvel being so overwhelmingly powerful. That they still make without continuous escalation, right, where the fights just get bigger and bigger.
That's the trouble. Having an OP hero.
Well, she's basically Superman in the Marvel universe. I mean, like she's that level of power. So you just have to come up with, Superman villains for her to fight. But like she's not on the same level of, Captain America and Iron Man. Like she's a Thor level, I would say. Like I think Thor and her could go toe to toe, but that's about it. Like,
well, and it'd be interesting to see. Because I think there was a bit of a backlash with her film because they and even in Endgame, we've only seen her really twice on screen. And I feel like they made the choice in the film they didn't make her a fun hero. They actually I think they made the less kind of entertaining choice but they didn't want to make just a fun, quippy hero like they have. They wanted to kind of go a different route with her, and we'll see if that sticks true. Like she is just an absolute self-assuredness that I think can turn people off, even in the point of even in the point of being a little bit off-putting, because that's central to the character.
I don't know if it's the script or how she plays it, but like they make her very kind of
she's a challenging character to like.
She's challenging, yes.
A little bit.
Yeah.
And I love the actress. I love Brie Larson. I think she plays her very well.
Yeah, I love Brie Larson. She's great.
Yeah, Carol Danvers just might be a challenging character to really like right off the bat.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem, she might have the problem, the Captain Marvel character might have the problem of she doesn't have, they're going to have to figure out, Sean even said it, that she's so OP, they're going to have to figure out really, really interesting villains to challenge her in interesting ways. Cause they can't just have her punching somebody into a moon or something every single time.
That's why Doom is the perfect villain, because Doom brings magic into it as well. And that changes the equation for the universe or galaxy sort of threatening universe threatening villain. I think multidimensional, magic based, mixed with extra dimensional science, all of that Doom brings to the table, and genius level, which means that he will have predicted and figured out all the various moves far in advance and will do everything. And ultimately, all her like super, super, super powers will be negated because she can't just punch her way out of the things that he puts up in front of her. So,
you're talking about the Lex Luthor effect, sort of like, Superman kill Lex Luthor in one, but like someone who is way smarter than him that puts challenges that he can't.
Same.
Well, and then still being able to make it a team fight, right? Where it's not just her, 1v1.
Right.
Yeah.
you know, that's what they did so well in Avengers is everyone had a viable role.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Yep.
The balance is going to be key for that.
Those are great movies. Great movies that I'm excited to see. I mean, they pushed everything back, right? Like release dates and
well, Black Widow's now coming
Black Widow
out
in the fall.
In November,
And even their Disney Plus stuff. Their pushback release dates, right?
Well, everything got delayed. Production got delayed on
nothing's
everything.
Filming. Yeah, nobody can work on stuff. Yeah,
that's. I mean, we'll have like I mean, think about this. We kind of have like a weird like we might have a little gap in films and new releases unless studios are just sitting on a bunch of stuff. But then there's going to be like a time that. Like, well, there's a lull between really like new movies.
There's gonna be a dry spell for sure.
Dry spell, yeah, exactly.
Well, I mean, you and Hannah are perfect examples of it. You guys aren't working on anything right now.
Nothing.
I mean, unless you know people, unless production gets accelerated and or picks back up, and then studios are able to push stuff out. But I mean, make good quality stuff.
Hannah's world, she's been told by her people that their studios are buying stuff, which is kind of interesting. Like they're getting ready for when things lighten up. It's sort of like this
makes
weird
sense
reaction.
For them. Yeah.
They like this, like buy up all the product they can. And then when the stuff is lifted, then
things will get back. They'll ramp up production on stuff.
Exactly. They can get,
there'll be so much pent up demand that they will.
Yep.
They will put things into production immediately, right?
Yeah, exactly. That would be a plan. It's sort of like because, like, I mean, however long this lasts, there might be like a lull in TV shows too. You know, a lack of newer content, seasons get pushed back. Hopefully, it's not lasting through the summer or extended periods of
months. My biggest fear is that they're going to go to all like bullshit reality stuff because that's easy to produce.
Yep.
Yeah,
you can shoot people in isolation, really.
Right.
There's even a show on Netflix called The Circle, and I think most of it takes place in like everybody's isolated in their own apartment. This was filmed before all of this happened.
Yeah.
And the only interactions they have are with each other are over the social media inside of the apartment building. Think about how that has become our reality now.
Susan and I have been commenting about this, and it's interesting because clearly some stuff is being produced, like ads are being produced. Susan and I were talking about this the other day about how it's so like clear that all of the ad agencies immediately flip to filming new ads that refer to and comment on and incorporate the COVID like environment right now.
Yeah.
It's just all the ads have just transformed into COVID as the tone, COVID is the reality. Mm-hmm. And
well,
so clearly
highlighting how the companies that they're advertising for are adjusting to life in the COVID world. So somehow sales will continue to go on and companies will continue to be able to stay afloat. So,
A lot of them, I guess, as I think back on it, none of them, it's probably easy to produce if they only have one actor who is talking to the camera or they're filming people that are in their homes or it looks like their home. So they're recreating that isolation effect. And so they can produce it looked like they can produce these ads without a big crew. Is that how that works, Patrick? Is it they can produce ads with one or two people and be done?
Well, I would say it's more likely that they're like the studio is buying up some like random bit of footage and then putting a voiceover to it. That's a lot easier to do that because like even if you film something like in a house with one actor, and minimal crew on like a commercial like that, the smallest thing I've ever been on is like for something like that is like five or six people.
Oh wow.
And like, I mean, film sets. And there was an article I was reading on in the Hollywood Reporter actually that was talking about like Hollywood's dark secret in the pandemic is that film sets are filthy, and that's completely true because no one washes their hands, no one goes to the bathroom, everybody touches their face and everything, and all the cameras and all the tripods and like like those stands are so, filled.
Those aren't getting wiped down and stuff.
Those aren't ever getting wiped down. They I said this before, it's like I was worried about going into this pandemic before they had canceled the production I was on, of how quickly this was going to spread through the crew. Like I was like, if we keep going, like this is terrifying because
that means that on some level everybody realizes the fact, or once they kind of take a step back and think about it, everybody who works on a set realizes that, you know what, the set is filthy. Nothing is wiped down. Nobody washes their hands. Everybody is so in such close proximity for such long hours that if one person has the flu, other people are going to get your flu. Yeah.
Anytime there's like a sickness on set, it always goes to like everybody. It's like inevitable. Yeah. Like the.
That's been our COVID-19 update for
COVID-19 update. Okay. So I've been watching, Hannah and I have been watching the Harry Potter movies. We're still doing that. We actually started the Deathly Hallows Part 1 last night. She is fully into it. We didn't finish it because she was falling asleep. But we're going to finish it today.
Actually, it's funny, Patrick. Ashton and I were talking about this yesterday, and I'll talk about what we did yesterday after you're done. But I want to, what structure did you... Like, how did you break up? Because you can't watch all 8 movies in one day. That's impossible. How did you structure the watch of the 8 movies?
No structure. Sort of just when we wanted to watch them, we watched them. She had seen the first two and thought they were like overwhelmingly kids movies, which they are. She hasn't read any of the books. No one has spoiled the ending for her. So
that's amazing.
That's
amazing. So she has not read the books, has no idea what's going to happen.
Oh my God.
You know, spoiler alert. I don't know if I need to say spoiler alert for this, but like, you know, she didn't know that Dumbledore was going to die. How did she
react to that?
I was going
to
say, did it crush her tiny little soul or what?
Oh yeah. She was very sad about this. Like it was very disappointing. And very interesting to see it through the eyes of someone who like doesn't know and like has, but there are, I will say this.
Okay. So tell me this, is watching things like that, is it a pain in the ass or is it awesome? Because she brings an artist eye to the,
right.
I can't wait till I could sit down all of us together in LA. Watching a movie with her.
Yeah.
Because I bet it's either illuminating and fascinating, which is what I expect, or is it annoying as hell because she's got a commentary about the artistry of everything and the craft of it.
She's able to just watch and not like dissect, right?
She's able to watch and not dissect, but there are some scenes in, you know, she'll comment to me about stuff like, I hate the shots don't match up, like that. Like she notices like directors decisions that she doesn't agree with, stuff like that. There are things that are in the book or in the movies that are like not really explained well because they go into more depth in the books. Like, like in the beginning of Deathly Hallows, she's like, why does Creature listening to Harry? They never explain it in the movie. And you don't really need to, it's not like a big thing, but you don't know that in the book, like Sirius left Harry the house and that's why he's, but they never explained it in the film.
That's a good point. Yeah.
So it's sort of like they're assuming a little bit that everybody's kind of knows what's going to happen or has some kind of knowledge of it. But like, so I think she is an anomaly. She's never read the books. She's never seen the movies. Happened. Like, I think that is extremely rare.
Yeah. For that's...
Considering and, they were so well, and I mean, when you're, I'll get into, yeah, but cause they were just pop culture events when they came out. Like, they were some of the, they were the biggest movies every year they came out.
Hell, I went to midnight book releases.
So did I, dude.
Yeah.
When I was in college, I went and bought Order of the Phoenix at midnight.
Yes. Has anyone ever done that? Like, where, like, they go to a midnight book release? Like,
no, they were cultural phenomenons.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So,
for sure. There will be a midnight book release for the next Game of Thrones book. I suspect, God, yes, right?
If he,
I mean, yeah,
the Winds of Winter, man. Whatever that.
Ten years from now.
Ten years from now.
Please, God. Please. God, yeah.
Oh my God. I mean, that's. I mean, he should just do nothing and just be finishing. I would love them. I would love Patrick Rothfuss to release the third Kaloth book.
Those two books are definitely the top of mind for next.
He's gone on record saying that he's like terrified to release it. That he doesn't. He's like worried about satisfying the fans. That it got
There seems to be some paralysis for him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's worried about how to finish it.
Yep. So, yep.
I follow him on Twitter, and he's been less active over the last few months. But there was a stretch where he would retweet every single day someone demanding that he finish the third book. Like he, that was kind of his, like, here's my daily tweet. You know, somebody would just tweet at him, finish the, like, he'd post something on Twitter, like a commentary about
it was his
breakfast or something. Yeah. He would be like, had eggs for breakfast this morning. They were disappointing. And then somebody would tweet at him, finish the fucking book.
Yeah.
And he'd be like, here's my daily reminder from my fans that they want my book. It got to be people. Hilarious. It went
people
on for
are
weeks.
Appalling. Yeah.
Yeah. It is that way. I mean, it's a book, guys. Calm the fuck down.
Yeah. No.
I mean, it's good and you love it, but calm the fuck down.
Are you, is anybody reading anything of geekery to contribute to the,
I haven't started anything new. I've been kind of rereading a couple of things. I think I'm actually, so this will segue actually. Ashton and I did a single day rewatch of Lord of the Rings, the extended edition yesterday.
All three.
We started at like 8:30 in the morning and we finished close to 9 last night. It was,
I mean, do you just want it to be like, it was a brutal, like,
that's not brutal. You're tired by the end. You're kind of worn out from watching something for that long and your blood hasn't been flowing that much that day. So you actually get tired more easily than you think. You don't exert a lot of calories, but by the end of the day, you're actually kind of worn out.
Your brain is worn out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, those movies are fantastic.
Yeah.
The extended edition.
Yes.
What Jackson chose to put back in and the themes that he chose to kind of highlight in those extended editions, especially in Return of the King, you really get a lot more of how Aragorn is very much a savior figure. And there's a lot of images surrounding that, building from Fellowship all the way into Return of the King. So that kind of going back in. There's literally a scene in Return of the King, the extended edition, after the big battle of Pelennor Fields, where Aragorn lays hands on someone, and then they are healed. I mean, he didn't heal them through magic, but the implication is, That's an image of a completely messiah / savior figure who is laying hands on an injured person and they become healed or they are healed in relation to that.
Well, there's some kind of hope in you. Like he represents hope and unity.
It's comfort.
Yeah.
I'm coming at it. You know how we were raised. You know how I'm coming at it in terms of, and I know how Tolkien wrote these books. They're Christian allegories,
right?
So coming at it from that, there's a lot more. And I don't think that, I don't think that Jackson is being preachy in any way, shape, or form by adding in those images, but it's definitely, it highlights the idea of a savior story. And I think that Jackson definitely is bringing that in.
Well,
what he adds to Return of the King. That's all.
Gandalf is in the, like in the extended books is like represented mostly as like he's like an angel like figure. Like he even dies and gets resurrected. Like,
oh yeah, no, he's transfigured. I mean, that's the term that, you know, Christians use about Jesus being transfigured. Yeah. There's definitely that kind of transformation of him from Gandalf the Grey to Gandalf the White, for sure. So there's a lot of that in there.
I don't know if I agree with Aragorn, you know, being teed up as savior, because I think he undermines all of that in those final scenes where he shifts all of the focus as the true heroes of the story to the hobbits.
Yeah.
It's less about Aragorn as the savior and much more about I think it's muddled. I think it's muddled in terms of messaging.
Oh, there. I don't disagree with you there in terms of how the story wraps up.
The woman who kills the the Witch King, you know, that kind of stuff. I think it's a complex.
Oh, I think that there's a lot more just than that. Yeah, I mean, but yeah. even what you're describing, the fact that Eowyn kills the Witch King and she is able to do it because she's not a man, and giving that, I mean, that power is uniquely hers.
Yeah.
But she's so badly injured in that fight that when she's in the house of the healing in Minas Tirith,
yep.
the image of Aragorn comforting her and laying hands on her even.
Yeah.
And then her healing kind of not directly as that, but that's the image that's in the movie. It's her care. He cares for her and she becomes healed.
Mm.
So that strikes to me. That hit me as this is a bit of a kind of a savior image, which I don't mind it, but I think I think it's put back in for that reason.
There's definitely chosen one kind of stuff.
Yes.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a better term, is chosen one.
Yeah.
But I mean, he is this figure that unites the, you know, he unites the armies, you know, he's able to
is
come he, back.
I need to rewatch those. I need to watch them again.
Yeah, is he supposed to be the king of Gondor and Rohan? Like, is that the implication at the end of the book? Is he's uniting the lands of humans, or is he just Gondor?
Just Gondor.
Yeah.
Right. He's the top human. I mean, it's really the broader statement is that they're entering the age of man, and he's the leader of the people, the mankind, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah.
I see.
But Rohan remains its own separate country.
But they don't have a king, and they don't have
the more senior partner, right?
Right.
They're just the big fancy, you know, white towers and bigger
the
army.
The front lines of Mordor, you know, with Mordor. Right. They are the first line of defense. Yeah. And the most important.
Those movies are incredible. They are so much fun to watch.
Is that 11 hours straight through? Is that
the first movie?
It's gotta be
the first movie
like
is about 3.5. The second movie is 3:45. And the fourth movie is about four hours and 15 minutes.
Well done.
Oh yeah. No. So, I mean, it's we watched the first one in the morning. We kind of took a break. We watched the second one in the afternoon, essentially. And then we took a longer break. We kind of got out of the house and went for a walk and went and got a snack. And then we came back and we ordered food, and we started the third one at about a little after 5 o'clock. And it, you know, finishes right around 9, or, you know, give or take. And we were, you know, we were tired, and
that's awesome.
That was the
it was awesome.
Is great.
It was a fun day. It was. And I hadn't done, there was so much in the extended edition. I mean, they add 45 minutes of stuff to the movie, so it feels almost like a completely different movie.
Yeah.
There's so much added to Return
there's
to the
so
game.
Much. There's yeah. so much added to there.
Yeah, yeah. So there was so much that felt new, because I've only probably seen the extended edition once or twice, and it's been years since I've watched the extended edition.
I love that.
So it felt new. It was great.
Mm.
But that is rekindled. I think I'm actually going to start a reread of A Game of Thrones, because it's kind of like peaking. I've tried to read Tolkien's. I've tried to read him. I just am not a huge fan of his writing, so it's just not easy for me to get through. So I think I'm going to endeavor a reread of A Game of Thrones.
You're going to reread Game of Thrones?
I might.
It's funny you say that. We're in the garage/casita cleaning, working on some stuff and cleaning out some boxes, and you know, ongoing effort to sort of get rid of more of our shit.
And the shit helped to move to Tucson 2 years ago?
Exactly right. And so, you know, we have our big bookshelves are set up in there. And so we have all of our, a lot of our books are on the shelves. And I came across my paperback single volume of Lord of the Rings. And I actually grabbed it, prompted by your rewatch of the movies. And I brought it in. And I'm going to do my once every 2 years reread of Lord of the Rings. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
You know what? Now, hold on a second. Before we go any further, I just had this thought, and I want everyone, I think everyone should participate. I mean, Chris, you've obviously read the book at least a dozen times. before Dune comes out at Christmas, we should reread the novel Dune.
100%. Oh yeah,
before the movie comes out.
Everybody saw the stuff in Vanity Fair, right? That came out.
Oh my god!
New imagery.
Yeah. Oh my god!
Yeah, like what do we think? The still suits, the armor, the daggers, the
Christopher.
Costume.
I mean, you're the Dune is your all time favorite book. What did you think?
Villeneuve is a genius. I'm all in.
Yeah.
Just like simple, like
I'm
colors
all
and interesting. There's obviously like Timothée Chalamet's like walking on the beach, and there's obviously like weird ships behind him floating.
That's in Caladan.
Yeah,
that's
I took away from that,
go to Arrakis.
Exactly. Right.
That's Caladan. That's House Atreides' homeworld.
Yeah,
I like the idea of, and I think it even came up in the article. I didn't read the whole article, but the idea of juxtaposing how Paul was raised on Caladan, this kind of water world, not water world, but like oceans and weather.
Yeah. And it's supposed to be raining a lot, right? Yeah. Yep.
And yeah. You know, this planet lush with water to going to this desolate, you know, very, you know, this desert planet, and how that would transform him, almost just the stark change in his life as a grown. Mm-hmm. I mean, because he's 15 in the book. It's a maturation story as much as it's anything else.
Yeah, I was going as soon as I saw the pictures, I went through the IMDb and try to remember like who's playing who, and like, you know, Stilgar and Duncan Idaho and like all those side characters and stuff like that. Man, this cast is crazy.
We should do just like we did with Golden Compass. We should do a chapter by chapter read and then this discussion leading up to it. So
Sean, you've obviously read the Dune. Have you read the Dune books?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Okay. No, what was your reaction? Did you see those photos this week?
I did. I liked it all. I was trying to remember, there was something that really caught my eye, and I think it was the still suits that I got hung up on.
Yeah.
Trying to associate those, and the challenges, you know, they got to show the actor's face still and
on
how they're going to manage that. But no, I'm looking forward to it. Absolutely.
Yeah,
I love the fact that they changed Liet Kynes to a woman of color. I think I'm not so wedded to. I mean, the book is a very white sort of white savior kind of 60s era perspective on the world, and I love the fact that they are updating it to be more diverse, more sort of reflective of sort of those ideas, that it's not white savior, that it's a more universal political and religious and environmental story. All of those are good changes in my mind. So I love that idea that there's no reason why the emperor's environmentalist or ecologist needs to be a white male. And so I love that.
Yeah,
I don't know if I was tracking this for two movies, right? There's
Oh, that's
a single book into two movies, which gives, I mean, so much time to just work through carefully all of the, you don't have to rush through it. They can really, really explore all the wonderful things.
Well, and we've discussed how they're, I mean, they're definitely going to end the first book with
the first movie with the Harkonnens, I think, attacking Arrakis.
Yeah, yeah. That's the natural breaking point, right?
So, right.
Well, and what I'm excited about splitting into two movies is the putting aside David Lynch's Dune, which is an abomination. The idea that Paul is the only character that's interesting, which is complete bullshit, because Jessica is, I would think, almost more interesting than Paul is the book. And having Rebecca Ferguson be able to play, give Rebecca Ferguson time to play Lady phenomenal. Jessica in the
first. Her arc is incredible.
Incredible.
Incredible in the book. And
it's that will be wonderful to see Ferguson play Lady Jessica, and how rich a character she is, and having time to develop with her will be just her.
The heavyweights involved.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've said it before. It has the opportunity to be the greatest science fiction movies of all time.
I was talking with Hannah about this, and I honestly think like he's got his work cut out for him. I think that it's a great book. I think it's a tough movie to do because there's a lot of weird stuff there's a lot of internal explanation for things. There's a lot of like nuance and weird stuff happening inside Paul's mind that is hard to do in film.
Yep.
Like
well, the mysticism is going to be very hard to pull off. The mysticism.
You guys are like sold that it's going to be this, you know, I believe it. I believe that if anybody can do it, he can do it. But man, the subject matter itself is very difficult to portray in film form.
You're absolutely right. Which
dude, he made compelling a story that is about math and language.
Right?
It's true.
Aliens who can't speak to you. Dude, they communicated symbols. He made that movie was so compelling, and that shit is obscure and opaque as it's capable of.
All right.
I'm making a good point. I think he's got it. I think he's got the ability and the vision to really
It's got to be really subtle and nuanced and slow. Well,
we'll find out at Christmas time. I mean, the movie's dropping at Christmas.
Well, I hope that, you know, are we sure that that's still going to happen? I hope that it happens.
They haven't announced any delays. I think that the curve is flattening enough that at least by the fall, we'll get some semblance of our normal lives back. Jeez. And I think going to the movies will be part of that. I think the fall will be normal enough that we'll be able to go to the movies.
Whew. Okay.
The issue is the time that's necessary to ramp up production again. Right. And
any other discussions before we go on to the Gloomhaven report?
Yeah. Well, I have two things. I have two things to report on. Pat, you mentioned earlier. Two things. I just started watching Devs. On Hulu. Okay. Oh my God. I strongly, again, you know what I like, and it's cerebral as hell. And Alex Garland, Ex Machina is one of my favorite movies of the last 10 years, right?
Yeah.
And he is the writer and director of the series, and it is a feast for the mind and the senses and the weirdness and the weird sci-fi tone. And anyway, I'm on episode 4 of that show right now, and it is a fascinating show. It's not hitting on all cylinders. It's a little slow. But damn, the ideas and the Nick Offerman is fantastic as the lead, sort of eccentric leader of this weird tech company. It's a quality show. Right. I encourage everyone to watch it.
Devs, okay.
Devs, yes.
I saw the trailer for it. It looked interesting, but it also like looked very strange.
It's very strange.
Yeah, the only drawback for the I saw the trailer as well, and the only drawback is I don't pay for Hulu, so I would have to get a Hulu account to watch Devs, and I'm already expending a lot of money on paid services right now.
I get it.
That's a choice that exists these days with like binge watching or like streaming culture. Is you miss out on certain things because they only appear on one platform.
I saw a really interesting graph on like how Americans are spending their money the past few months, and like, you know, no one's going out to eat, no one's shopping at any grocery, like shopping, like just like buying clothes. Like everybody's buying everything on Amazon, or they're ordering, but everybody's like Caviar and Postmates and Uber Eats are all like skyrocketing like crazy. And
you guys know my company. I mean, I work in insurance claims, and my company has put a moratorium. Just as your insurance professional today, if you're going to drive for like DoorDash or Postmates, normally your regular auto policy would disclaim coverage. It's not something that's covered. If you just drive, you know, for delivering food for a fee, is generally excluded. But most insurance companies are putting a moratorium on that for like 30 to 45 days. Check your policies. You may not be covered, but insurance companies are extending coverages because so many more people are driving for these food delivery rideshare or food delivery TNC companies.
Yeah,
because
our daughter's doing it. They're using our car to deliver food for her employer.
Yeah, Yeah. So it's, yeah. Anyway, that's your insurance nerd it's crazy. It's just, commentary. It's,
no, it's
insurance
just
a nerd moment.
Yeah. I got to put, I have a certain kind of expertise and this is what it is. So I'm sometimes proud of what I do. And right now it's, you know, I can offer knowledge about what's going on in the world in a very specific way.
It's a public service.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Very, 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 very small public service.
Okay. So for those of us who don't know anything about Gloomhaven, like tell us,
I'm not done.
What?
God,
what
you're else? So yeah. Like jumping. I want to talk about the book. I'm reading.
Move along. Come on.
Okay, Jesus. Here we go. What's the book you're reading?
I am reading Neal Stephenson's latest book, Fall.
Oh,
okay.
Sean is a fan of Neal Stephenson, right?
Yeah.
Are you reading that book, Fall, Sean?
No. Is it new? I'm not even tracking that one.
It's his newest one. It's called Fall or Dodge in Hell.
It actually
is set in the same universe of his previous book that dealt with. Remember, Dodge was the creator of the World of Warcraft esque massively multiplayer online game. Remember that book? I'm forgetting the name of it. It's the one previous to the Seven Eves book.
I don't know.
Anyway, Seven Eves was the last I read.
Yes, and Seven Eves was the one that was after the book that was. Damn, I can't. Hold on. Let me for benefit of the readers, indulge me. I need to walk through these books. Just hold on. I'll remember.
I'm waiting. I'm waiting patiently.
Please wait patiently. Okay. Reamda. R-E-A-M-D-E. Remember, that's the book.
Reamda.
Okay.
Reamda. That book was about this, the head of a massive company that had created sort of the single online world that everybody in the world is now part of, much like Ready Player One, but much more sort of World of Warcrafty. And its economy had influence on the world economy, stuff like that. So anyway, that world, the leader of that company is the Dodge of Fall or Dodge in Hell. And the premise of this book, and Stephenson is, I like his books. He is not an easy read. They are very dense. This book is 900 plus pages long. almost 900 pages. And it's a fascinating examination of technology advances to the point where people's brains and memories, who they are, can be mapped and put into a computer.
Okay.
And so it's an examination. I'm not going to give any spoilers, but I'm reading this. I'm like 500 pages in. And it's really set in that world, but farther in the future, where things happen, people die, but they create this collection of cloud-based servers that stores the scanned individuality, for lack of a not souls, individuality of these people into these servers. And then what Stephenson, which I love about Stephenson, is he goes into all the implications of what that would mean if we have the technology to do that. That means that there is a cost and associated with maintaining all of those computers forever, or you are killing again everyone that you've scanned into those computers, right? I mean, he examines the detail involved in the cost, the power, the computing power, the backup systems, all the implications. What's the legal structure, the corporate structure, who has responsibility, all of that.
You can see why Chris loves this.
I was going to say, I don't want us to sound, this is interesting? Question mark?
Yes, it is. It's okay. Very interesting. Okay. But
he must be the greatest writer alive if you make something this dense.
Well, it is interesting. It's interesting to me because it's an intersection. It's an intersection of all the things that get me up in the morning, right? It's existential, right?
Yeah.
But it also is, what are the implications of all of this for real human life and the reality of dealing with it? But it also tells a story from the perspective of people who are inside this computer structure. They're having thoughts. They are in interaction with other people that are other individuals that are inside the computer. And what would that mean?
Yeah.
It's fascinating to me. That's what I'm reading.
There's two things that come to mind when you talk about this. There's actually there are no computer bodies, right? It's just they're in a server. They're not robots.
No, they are not robots. Because they are in a virtual environment.
That's Ghost in the Machine is what you're talking about. When you take it to that level, it's the human mind inside of a robot body is
not. Yeah, that's
ghost,
this is ghost not
in
that.
The shell. Ghost in the Shell.
Yeah, Ghost in the Shell. Yeah.
And then there's actually an Amazon show that I saw a preview for where the guy he is killed and his brain is downloaded into a killed people server that's maintained by a corporate thing. And he lives his life inside of this Matrix-esque. It looks like a comedy series, not to the severity of what you're talking about.
Yes.
I can't remember the name of it.
It's much like that. Anyway, I'm enjoying it very much, but it is a dense read that is a long book.
Is this a planned cycle of novels? I mean, is it a direct sequel to the first one?
Not a direct sequel. It's just set in the same world with the same characters. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Cool.
Mm-hmm. Yep. All right. On to the Gloomhaven update.
Yes.
Give us sort of a basic idea of what we're dealing with here.
Well, here let's talk about this. I have a different way that I'd like to frame this. So we know Gloomhaven was a Kickstarter that was kicked off a couple of years ago. Were both of you involved in the Kickstarter for the original Gloomhaven?
No, I was not.
Okay.
I think Chris told me about it before he got the game, but I did not contribute. I contributed to the second one, but not the first.
Okay.
Oh yeah.
Okay. So
Frosthaven.
In terms of that was the first one, Frosthaven, correct?
No, Frosthaven is the newest one.
Is the newest one? Okay,
upcoming,
one. So
not out yet.
Yeah, Gloomhaven
$7 million on Kickstarter.
Jeez,
okay.
So in your mind, Christopher, in your mind, and I don't think we know you contributed to the Kickstarter. In your mind, what was kind of the selling point or the benefit for you to contributing to the Kickstarter for a tabletop game? What interested you in that?
What interested
you're asking
me,
this question because you don't think you would ever do this.
Well, I want to understand why, because I don't. I mean, I've contributed to things in the past. I've contributed, I think, to one or two Kickstarters. For a tabletop game, I guess I'm not a tabletop gamer, so I'm interested because
that's the real
understand the thought process.
The question behind the question. There you go.
It scratched multiple itches for me, which is, my formative years were all around Dungeons and Dragons, right?
Okay.
And also my formative years were associated with, remember the Dark Tower board game? Did you guys ever, have you ever heard of that?
No.
The Black,
Black Tower. It's yes, I remember. Okay.
So,
I remember that.
So it scratched multiple itches for me. And I like tabletop gaming. We have multiple tabletop games. We do that. And so its appeal sort of ticked off multiple boxes for me in terms of as an adult, being, lots of my, things I follow, obviously very, very much a deep nerd. So I am plugged into lots of streams of nerds talking about nerdy things. And so it was being talked about a lot. And I was like, I gotta be involved in this. And I looked at it, and it's the barrier to entry. It's not a cheap game. It's like complicated. And so it appealed to a lot of sort of those aspects of, I have the money to contribute to it. Mm-hmm. I want to get in on this.
Chris, was it the first Kickstarter you did?
Veronica Mars was the first. Veronica Mars movie was the first Kickstarter I did.
Okay.
Wow. But this was the second Kickstarter I participated in. It had all of those elements, sounded awesome. And the other thing that it allowed for and described is you can play it solo if you want.
Wow. Okay. Which is different than most tabletop games.
Correct. Well,
most tabletop games are two or more, you know.
Correct.
Like minimum.
And so if push came to shove, like if I can't find anybody here to play with, I don't have any friends. I immediately was thinking of you guys and Sean, right?
Sure.
Figuring out a way to play together. But I mean, I got the game and I didn't open it because I wanted to, the first experience with it, I wanted it to be with Sean. So I brought it. I brought it with me.
Let me, before you even go any further, I have one other thing I want to ask about the Kickstarter idea of it. I mean, the crowdfunding idea of a movie, the fandom that exists inherent with crowdfunding something like Veronica Mars, I think I can immediately kind of understand. The idea of kickstarting being part of a Kickstarter for a tabletop game, and why in your mind would a creator of a tabletop game want to do a Kickstarter? I mean, I assume
because it's the economics of it.
No one's going to make the game.
The producer, tabletop game company.
Yeah.
This is an uber niche.
Yeah.
They would view this as uber niche, right?
And no one's going to buy it, right?
The only way that they would put money into making it is if you were going to establish a floor to defer much of the costs associated with production of the game.
Gotcha.
And the only way, and that's what Kickstarter is great for, is that it's the same economics related to the Veronica Mars movie. Like Veronica Mars was a show that lasted 3 seasons, and then but it has such a built-in fan base that when the creator and owner of the Veronica Mars IP says, "Hey, Rob Thomas, I want to make this, and the stars are all aligned, and they want to do it. Let's kickstart it," because then he pitches it to a production company, and the production company knows that the money they put in is on top of the $5.5 million that was already contributed to the making of the movie.
Yeah.
And so it's the same thing with Gloomhaven. Was the creator had the idea, but it was going to be an unbelievably expensive game to make.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so I'm sure that he went to multiple gaming companies and said, "Let's make this game." And they were like, "Oh, hell no."
It has thousands
of pieces, and I don't know how many pieces.
Well, and I'm
cards.
I am not a tabletop gamer. I was not raised in that era. I wasn't raised kind of like, so I don't have an engendered kind of love of that comes from being part of that, from being young to like growing into it as well. So I think that what you're describing has an extremely high for a non-fan, for a filthy casual like I would be with tabletop gaming. Something like this has just such the idea of the high penetration point for wanting or being excited to play. Like this type of game has a very, very high penetration point. And it would have to be, the offset of that would have to be, we're crowdsourcing it with people who will put in the time and effort to play this game and are excited by things like this, but it's not necessarily going to be for everyone. And I completely understand and accept that. And I do not think that it's a bad thing, because you're designing something for the most hardcore of tabletop gaming fans.
That's the commentary on our modern society is that thing that you like, you can have it. Like
someone out there is going to make it for you.
Someone out there is going to make it for you. It exists. You know,
and if you can find enough of people who are of a similar interest who are willing to put up $100, you can get it made.
You can get
and has the added benefit of those people feeling like they have. I mean, the downside of modern fandom is people think they own every fucking thing that they love.
It's true.
But this is the upside of being part of a Kickstarter is you do actually own something that you love.
Well, and it creates community. People are always looking for community, right? Geeks are one set of community. There are lots of communities, gun buyers, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's you form a community
people
around it and you're plugged in.
People who sell exotic tigers to each other is one
exactly,
kind of
exactly. Good reference.
There's a whole community of crazy.
Sean, did you
people.
Watch Tiger King? Or have you
No, I have been listening to you guys talk about it.
Bananas. Can't do it. Yeah, no, it's
appalling I think
the other thing that the Kickstarter's got to give some freedom to the creator, right? That he can make the game he wants without having to answer
Like if they sold this board game to a board game company, I can't name one actually. Like, but
Avalon Hill, something like that. Yep.
Yeah, they sell it to a company. They might have their own criticism about how to make the game. Like
too many pieces,
right? Yep. You know, you gotta you can't
the price
make it
points
like that.
Too high. The price points too high,
right?
Yep.
Or you gotta
this
change,
has to
you
sell
gotta,
for $50 at Barnes gotta, and Noble, shit like
yeah,
that.
Exactly. Right. You gotta make it.
It's
this
mass
way,
market.
But,
yeah.
But like
yeah.
Kickstarter, he can make it however he wants. And
that's right.
And but the thing is that you know you took the risk on this game could have sucked. You know. Yep. This game could have been like made poorly, but you don't.
And
feel
I would have
that
been
way.
Miserable trying to sort of break through that barrier to entry that Andrew describes.
Yeah, exactly.
I haven't seen any photos. I've seen the outside of the box, and I've seen like
I sent a photo of my setup. Did you not post that on?
I did not post that on Instagram.
Andrew's failing.
I failed it, dude.
Why
do you do this?
You're fired.
I'm terrible.
You're fired,
Sean. Do you want to start a podcast?
Chris
we'll
is the legendary listener.
Seriously.
Absolutely.
I would listen to the Gloomhaven report, even if it was just.
That's not a bad idea. Actually,
it's really. Honestly, there's probably 50 Gloomhaven podcasts out there.
That's probably right.
Two jukebox just sitting in their living room playing Gloomhaven for 5 hours at a stretch.
Andrew, shut up.
I'm all about it.
They have so many add-ons. So there's the game, right, with all the pieces that we talked about. But, Chris, I think you have the specialized box, right, that all the pieces go in?
I do, yeah.
And then,
is this an attractive like shelf display type of thing?
No. It's an organizer.
Organizer. Oh, okay. There's the add-on the stickers that we both have for this. You know, the removable stickers so you can replay it without using the permanent stickers.
Yeah, because it's a game where we haven't really described the sort of the base concept of the game.
I want a description of just how it looks and
go ahead, Sean.
You do. Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead.
There's a couple. The main board is just a world map.
Okay.
And then you don't really play on that board. It's really just a map for reference. And as you unlock scenarios, you put a sticker on the board to show that you can now go to that place.
And it alters the map. Like the design of the game is that as you progress in your campaign, you change the board. Mm-hmm. Permanently. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So the aftermarket has created removable stickers so you can start over. And your mm-hmm. board is not permanently changed. You can get removable stickers.
Kind of a choose your own adventure aspect to it.
Okay, that's cool.
Next question. From a completely kind of, there has to be a randomizer functionality to this game is what I, is there like a card deck that you're pulling things from? Just, this is very, very
so
basic.
So you have the world, right? And then, and then you, and your characters and you do things with them in the big map. But really the game is played when you step into a scenario, which you can think of as a dungeon.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's where it becomes, and I never played like Magic or any of the card based games really, but it there's no dice. It's a,
So
we play our characters with a deck of cards that have attack and movement pieces to them.
Yeah. Okay.
And we play against the adversary, the monsters.
And they have their own card too, and their own attacks.
Every monster has their own deck of cards.
Yeah.
Okay.
And their
so the permutations are incredibly complicated.
Yeah. And then and then there's modifier cards that come into play that change the base attack or move.
So
as it's unfolding.
So like in Dungeons and Dragons, like I'm up against a goblin, like I roll my attack dice to see if I hit him, and I have like all these modifiers that do the thing, but there's no dice in this game. So you're just flipping over a card that says I use my scimitar to attack the goblin. And
so a base turn kind of goes when you're in combat. Chris and I will decide you play two cards, and so you go through your remaining cards and you pick the two you want to play. And they have initiative values.
And it's a it's a resource. It's a allocation of resources, limited resources type idea.
Yeah, so it's all about how you're going to spend.
Each character is limited to in a scenario to a deck, and you get what the choice comes in is selecting the cards that you're going to use for that scenario, and then that's it.
Is it like this one character has like three attacks or something like that? Is that the idea? Or
no,
has
you always play two cards, and usually it's one is a movement and one is an attack.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And your cards are continuously dwindling. There's a whole card management piece to it, but throughout the scenario, you have to finish before you have run out of cards.
If you say you flip the movement and finish the attack, are you always hitting that person, or is there like the creature flips over, he flips evade or something, and then miss?
There's things like that. So there's modifiers that can null out your attack. And you don't have to. It's like sometimes you're healing or just moving, depending on what's going on in the game.
Right.
And then
right.
some of them have abilities that like you said, negate the attack for whatever reason.
Okay. So you're fighting the other randomness of the guy because you're not picking what the goblin's doing or creature or whatever. Like
no, that's the random element to the round. Like or a turn, a round involves everybody's turn, everybody's opportunity. And so just like Dungeons and Dragons, there is an initiative, and that initiative determines the order of who gets to act. And it can be a mix of, depending on the party, who in the party has the best initiative. And then the monster might have an initiative number that either is before everybody or in between everybody or last. And so the randomness is in the flip of the card from the monster deck. Like we get to choose which cards we want to use in every round. And so that the part of the elimination of the randomness is with the lack of dice is that there's no die that's determining initiative or anything like that. It is we get to choose which characters of our characters that we can control what their initiative is going to be. And so part of the rules of the game are such that Sean and I can't tell one another. Like the way that we're doing this is he controls two characters.
That was another question I was going to ask. Continue your thought, but I have another question about the characters.
But the rule of the game, which we've been good about sort of following, is that we cannot tell each other the exact initiative number that our characters are going to have. What we do is that I'm going for a low initiative, and that sort of signals sort of what the order, what we desire the order to be like. But oftentimes And why initiative is important is if you move first, if your character move first, it is going to draw the attention of the monster. And so your character that moves first,
you're going to pull aggro.
You are going to pull aggro. Exactly. Yeah. And so, like, and this has happened to my squishy
we
character.
We have learned
the hard way. Yes.
Okay.
Where
so
my, go ahead.
Okay. So hold on. Is that, so just to get into the weeds a little bit about how you guys are playing this, you guys are playing, you're phone calling each other and have identical boards.
Correct.
Chris lives in Tucson, Sean lives in Colorado. So you guys are calling each other, making sure you have identical boards, and then just communicating over the phone.
I brought the game, like I cracked it open, and Sean and I together unboxed my game for the first time.
Oh, that's awesome. How
it
was
so
unboxing?
Awesome. I mean, it was a disassembly of hundreds of pieces, right?
Oh my gosh, okay.
Yeah.
It took us hours and hours just to disassemble.
And
the
we
game,
had to watch,
unbox
I mean,
the
wasn't
game.
It like a 2-hour YouTube tutorial
on
how to play?
Yes.
Wow.
Is this a third party creating this tutorial? Is just like the creator?
No, it's
tutorial?
The it's the creators.
Oh wow, that's cool.
And it's you know, you don't get a giant rule book. Really, the rule book is pretty thin.
Yep. Yeah.
And you could figure it out if you had to, but the YouTube video certainly explained it better.
That's fun.
Yeah, for sure.
Anytime I bought a new board game, I would go try to find a YouTube tutorial because like seeing
it's really
it,
helpful.
While,
yeah.
Yeah. Seeing it while you like learn the game, like they go through a round is always better than when like reading a rule book for me.
It really it's helped. Like, yeah. It really
yeah,
helped.
Yeah. Like seeing how the game actually interacts and what your choices are. Anyways.
So we played the game. We did an actual like couple scenarios that first time, didn't we, Sean? In Colorado.
We did, yeah.
Around the holidays. And so and then we finished and then I boxed it up and brought it back to Arizona and then I didn't play again.
Mm-hmm.
But it planted the seed in Sean, and then I don't know, maybe a year later, Sean, you bought.
Yeah,
it?
Yeah, I can't because I went and checked right away, and it was like $250 at the time.
Whoa. Yeah, they were the sold out. Really it was sold out, and so aftermarket sellers were putting it on eBay and other sites, and they were over doubling the cost of the game.
Wow.
It was such in demand, and so the second printing came around, and I think Sean. You bought the second printing, right?
Yep.
Yeah. And so then Sean had his own box and I had my box. And so we decided to continue our campaign, but together, like you said, Andrew, identical setups, original characters. We just continued what we had started with my box. We just continued that.
Do your character has to have names given to them in the game, or have you assigned names to your character?
We get to assign the names, all of that. Yeah.
Okay.
Is there like a bunch of characters to choose from, or are you
classes and stuff like that?
Yeah, yeah.
There's classes. Probably okay. I don't know, maybe 8 to start with, and then there's at least another 8 that we have not unlocked yet.
And you unlock those additional characters as you progress in the campaign.
Is there is it like a magical supernatural element too? Is there a text level to imagery and way to play the game? Or is it I throw spells and stuff like that? Or do you have guys who are like, you know, I've got my gun that I use or something like that?
No, it's very much, at least so far, fantasy based.
Okay,
I would say.
Okay.
Although my tinker has a flamethrower, but
there is a steampunk. It's mainly fantasy.
That's kind
steampunk.
Of like. Yeah. I was looking to see, you know, if there's a genre. There's a cross genres. Is there? You know, the idea being that you're and Gloomhaven refers to the world that you're in, the city that you're in. Is it like
the base city?
The city.
Okay. Yeah, is it a medieval city, or does it feel more different like a steampunk-y like kind of twist on Victorian idea, like the setting itself? How does it feel for you guys? What kind of setting is Gloomhaven?
That's a great question. I wouldn't say it's not high fantasy.
Okay.
But fantasy, you know, Thieves World.
Okay.
D&D-ish.
Okay.
With like Chris said, some steampunk vibe.
Okay,
especially in the characters. You know, one of my characters is a tinkerer, and he's got all sorts of gadgets and can stun people. And
Okay, that's cool.
You know, grappling hook and.
Oh, that's fun.
And it's okay. Not the only. Well, I don't know. The brute is not a human. Is the brute a human?
No.
No. Yeah. See, the only human in our party is my female scoundrel. She is a human, sort of assassin thief kind of character.
Okay.
My other character is an elemental character. He's a Craighart, and he is sort of a earth magic, rock kind of.
So there's definite like. I hesitate because sometimes it has negative connotations, but I think that just as in our understanding of how kind of genre things work, there's definitely a bit of archetype surrounding archetype/class. I mean, because you describe a scoundrel, my mind immediately goes to she's going to have maybe dodge abilities. She's going to have kind of, you know, trap abilities. Maybe she's going to have abilities where, you know, maybe like a sneak ability, like stealth ability. Stuff
all
like
of that.
So my mind immediately
got
goes
all to of that.
Okay, cool. Okay, so the conception, my conception of the game and the character play is maybe
there's
forming
tanks.
Up a little bit.
I mean, it is the standard sort of WoW, but with some variations. There's
sure, of course.
Tank, damage dealer,
a support
healer. Yeah,
okay,
yep.
Right.
It's that sort of archetype for sure.
Do you guys have favorite archetypes to play in the game? That's my last question that I'm going to ask. I'm going to let you talk, Marty.
You know, it's funny. Usually I always go for like a hunter-like character, you know, but...
years, and I think, Sean, you kind of had the same kind of thing going on.
Yeah,
I'm curious
yeah.
if you guys
Sean,
are attracted.
Sean played a druid.
I played... So in the game, I have the most tank-like character. Chris's
okay.
Craighart can tank too, but my guy is definitely... First one through the door whenever possible.
Okay.
And then the Tinker is a support character that a lot of heals and a lot of other like having to do with card management support functions.
And
a little bit of range damage.
The Scoundrel is straight up assassin. Squishy assassin, which is why we've learned in the past that and she is quick to move, and so if I make a mistake and I take initiative and have really low initiative and go through the door, she's going to draw attention, and if I can't immediately go invisible, she's going to get
killed.
She'll
die.
Yeah.
That has happened.
That has happened. So
Is it like permadeath, or they can,
no,
they can be resurrected?
Not permadeath.
Okay, yeah. Okay, good.
Yeah, it's
out for this scenario.
The game is called, the game treats it as exhausted. And so if you run out of cards, you're exhausted, or if you go in and you exceed your health, you're exhausted. It's not permadeath. Yeah.
Gotcha. It seems really interesting.
It seems dense, but not in the way that you would get bored from the density.
The layers
peel back to more layers, which just keeps you interested.
I won't speak for Sean, but I think for Sean and me, the appeal is the mix of really strategic approach to tactical combat.
Okay.
And positioning and order of attack and setting up and support of your other attack. And the character's coordination of all of that is hugely fun because there is a tactical sort of element to it, which Sean is really good at. And
but there's not like a grid map with a little token on the, is there?
Yeah,
like,
there is.
When you go in the scenario, we didn't describe that, but then you pull out all the other map pieces.
They're map tiles you can arrange
together.
Oh, I see.
Okay.
And so, I mean, probably the first 45 minutes of every session is us just setting up the scenario.
Yeah.
Right.
All the monsters, the rooms, the doors, the traps, the map.
Oh, wow.
Is that a function of the complexity of the scenario or kind of the limitations of your communication ability because you're in two different places?
No, it's I mean, we're both setting it up individually.
Yep. Yeah.
But then, you know, you gotta reset your characters. You go to town, and then events happen in town and on the road.
You pull a card, a city event. Something is happening all the time, and it's all driven by these various decks. So when we're in the city, there's a city deck where there's an event in the city that can alter either the sort of what's happening with us in terms of reputation or otherwise. And then when you go to the new location, there's a road event that you also pull that can have positive or negative impacts. Like today, this morning we played, and today's scenario is our going into the demon element, the elemental element to take on the prime demon. Like this is the second boss we will have fought.
Yeah.
And, you know, the road event that we did today was you draw a card and you come across, you're hungry and you come across a bush that has red berries on it. And you get to decide, do you eat the berries or do you not eat the berries?
Okay. And
then what you, Sean and I talk and your the party sort of decides, here's what we're going to do. And then you read the outcome based upon the choice that you make. And there are two outcomes. And sometimes the outcomes are driven by what are the characters that you're using? Do you have this character in your party? Here's the result. If you have this character in your party, that kind of thing. So, oh, wow. Yeah, today was we chose not to eat the berries, and that was a good choice because if we had eaten the berries, we would have been started the scenario with poison.
Oh okay. Yeah. Wow.
Okay.
Yeah, wow. And the thing I like about it, I mean, the core of the game is you're on the scenario map just fighting, you know, the mechanics of the cards, but they paid equal attention, as good as that is, the strategic game where you have all these events in the city and on the road, the unlocking of locations in the map, the overarching story is really high quality. And just, you know, your party's reputation increases and that unlocks certain things, or it can decrease if you do bad stuff.
And
so the complexity surrounding kind of the core, you know, dungeon fight is really well done. It's just really fun.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Well, I think honestly, I think I'm sold. I think once quarantine ends, I'm coming down and I'm.
I want to see it.
Yeah, I want to see it now. Yeah.
Post that picture I sent you to Brothers Geek. Yeah.
Sounds good. I'm sold. Running a little long. So Andrew.
Oh God, I don't have a trivia question. What? I totally forgot. Oh my gosh.
Andrew, I will step in.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
Legendary listener comes through again.
Yes, he does.
Because you suck at your job, Andrew.
Totally suck. Oh my God. I totally forgot. To get a trivia question.
I was looking up some numbers while we were talking just because I was curious. So here we go. We're going to compare Gloomhaven and Monopoly.
Yes.
And the question is numbers of units sold. And so So give me a guess for how many sets of Monopoly have been sold since its invention sets of Gloomhaven have been sold.
Oh my God.
I'm going to, for Monopoly, I'm going to go 100 million, I think.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's got,
Yeah, 100. Yeah. And I think I would get for Gloomhaven, I'm going to guess 50,000.
Okay. I'm going to say 25,000 for Gloomhaven and 150 million Monopoly.
So far, I'll give Chris a hint. So far, you're both low.
Okay.
Both.
Wow.
Okay.
Okay. So, for Monopoly, it's probably 400 million.
Possible.
Of all the various iterations of Monopoly.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. The probably various iterations.
400
for sure.
million. And I'm going to say my initial number that I had in my mind for the original Gloomhaven was 200,000.
Okay.
You're exactly right for Gloomhaven.
Based on
what I'm looking at.
Nice.
And I don't see a date for this, but, it's talking about Frosthaven, so it can't be that old.
Yeah.
And then, Monopoly. And I think this is just the base game. So not all the third party.
Yeah,
copies, right. But 250 million.
Wow.
That's pretty incredible.
I mean, it's been around since like the 50s, right? Like Monopoly, it's been around a long time.
Yeah, it might be older than that.
Be older than that. Yeah,
jeez,
but that's wild. That's awesome. That's great.
Yeah,
200,000 Gloomhaven.
200,000 Gloomhaven.
That means there's going to be I mean, Chris, how plugged in, or I mean, Sean, I'm sorry, how plugged in are the two of you to like the Gloomhaven kind of social media world? Like, do you follow multiple Gloomhaven accounts on Twitter? Do you guys follow, are you part of things on Facebook when it comes to Gloomhaven, so, things like that?
Now with the, so we just did the Kickstarter for Frosthaven.
Yeah.
And now like he's pushing out an email every day that talks about, it's really focused on the development of Frosthaven. And
which is
interesting. You know, guests that are coming in and and then they talk a lot about, and Chris, you may track some of these, they talk a lot about other games, and so the community, you get exposed to the community because he's having, you know, developers come in to write a scenario that worked on
that's fun.
This other game.
Cool.
Yeah, it's really, there's a couple that I'm like, oh man, I'm gonna have to get that.
The
way they talk about it.
I'm a lurker on the Gloomhaven Reddit. So if I have a question or a thought or whatever, I will go to the Gloomhaven subreddit and sort of just read about what's going on, what are people talking about on the subreddit, and that will lead me down a rabbit hole, sort of other things on the internet related to Gloomhaven. And we're doing this all the time, Sean and I, where we have a question about sort of what the effect of this might be, or what's the order, or the rules aren't entirely clear about this thing. And so there's a whole like community that has answered or tried to answer all of the questions that Sean and I have ever come up with as we're playing through it. So
that's awesome.
It's a huge, it's a huge, dedicated, very interested community. You know, people love the game. We love the game. So it's fun to be plugged into all of it.
Like I said before, the Kickstarter itself engenders a feeling of ownership, literal ownership and something like that. So that's great. That's awesome that the community is so involved. That's awesome.
And we've just scratched the surface, honestly, because we're, how many?
I think we're on our 10th. Scenario, and there's what, 90 or 95?
Yeah.
Whoa,
yeah.
I was That's just awesome. Gonna ask, like, how much time have you guys put in this, and how much is left? God. There's so many hours left.
Versus value is very high.
It's a probably 300-400 hours.
That's awesome.
Oh my god, whoa,
and we're doing our 10th scenario, so it's phenomenal. I mean,
that's awesome.
Yeah, the entertainment value for what it cost. That ratio is astronomical.
That's awesome.
Great. That's great.
So cool. If you'd like to help Andrew with his trivia, because obviously he needs help,
I forgot.
You should email him at kingofthenorth52@gmail.com. You should follow us on Twitter, brothers_geek @twitter.com, brothersgeekpodcast@gmail.com, brothersgeekpodcast on Facebook, Spotify, iTunes, Brothers Geek Podcast. Sean, do you have anything to plug before we go?
Nope. I'll give a shout out for Fallout 4, which has been entertaining me quite a bit. And,
okay.
Glad the Picard one shots are over.
Okay. Sean, they just did an expansion on Fallout 4, right? They just dropped new content for that in the last week or so?
No, that's Fallout 76.
Oh, Fallout 76. My bad. Yeah. Okay, cool.
Have you been playing that at all, 76?
No, the only Fallout I've ever played is 4, and I pulled it back out for quarantine, and it's a really good quarantine game.
It's awesome. A great quarantine game.
Are
you playing that on
Xbox, John?
I am, yeah, and it's great on the Xbox.
Oh, no kidding. Yeah. I don't think I've ever played a single Fallout game.
They're great.
Yeah, I bet you can get it for probably $20 or something.
And oh wow!
It's you would enjoy it a lot, actually. It's a great solo kind of first person shooterish.
Nice. Mm-hmm. All right, I'll check that out.
Cool. It's my least favorite of the Fallout games. Besides, 76 was pretty meh, but like 3 was really good. The story of 3 was really good, and New Vegas is like legendary as being like amazing. So, but Fallout 4 is very good. 4 is very, very, very fun.
All right.
So,
Sean, thanks for coming on.
Great having you on.
Hey, thanks, guys. Yeah.
We will definitely have you back on for the Gloomhaven update.
Yeah, we need more Gloomhaven
updates.
Sure.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun today.
there's years of that ahead of us.
Yes, awesome.
I'm excited.
Content, dude. It's content for the podcast.
That's right.
Podcast.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, brothers.
Have a good one.